Good. Well, welcome. Welcome, everyone. I hope you've been having a good time. It certainly looks like people have been having a good time. My name's Tim. You may or may not know that this event this evening has been put on by members of St. Helen's Church, and of course with help from our expert food and drink-minded friends as well, but put on by guys from St. Helen's Church, which is a church just a few minutes that way over in the city. We're really glad that you can all join us here tonight. At St. Helen's Church, we're people who are followers of the Lord Jesus, and we love getting into conversations, chats, discussions about Jesus, about his claims. And we hope that tonight is going to be an evening like that, where we get a chance just to have conversations about what we're about to hear. Jamie is going to come and talk to us for about 20 minutes. What do you need to know about Jamie? Jamie is one of the leaders over at St. Helens. He's a Brummie, although when he comes and speaks, you might not be able to tell that if you didn't know that, so listen out. But he is a Brummie. He now lives just down in Borough with his wife Susie and his three little kids. And so Jamie's going to come. He's going to speak for about 20 minutes. After that, there'll be time to more time for chat and having drinks and stuff together. But I'm going to hand over to Jamie.
Nice one. Thank you, Tim, very much. Welcome to the Wren. Welcome to our event. I can see a lot of this going on, and I kind of understand why. You're going to get to watch me sweat for about 20 minutes. That's going to be the main event, okay? What is it? 36.5 degrees today? I made a slight mistake. I said to someone, apparently it's the hottest day ever on record. That is a slight overstatement, but I think I'm right in saying it's the hottest day in the UK in July. What? On the 1st of July? Only the 1st of July. Come on, in July. Let's just go big. It's the hottest day ever, apparently. My little girl said to me when I got home today, she said, Daddy, she's 5 years old, she said, Daddy, it is a big hot today. And I know how she feels, it's a big hot. But I'm really glad you've been able to join us. We thought about this event a couple of months ago, and this was exactly the scene that I had in mind. I don't think you quite say it's an iconic venue, but this is a Christopher Wren church. Did you know that? Christopher Wren designed this. And we're not actually quite in the shadow of, but almost in the shadow of the Christopher Wren church building, St. Paul's Cathedral, on the edge of the River Thames. We've had great food. We've got good drink. The company, you can judge for yourselves. A nice atmosphere, and of course, the weather exactly as we planned it. Everything has come together really, really well. And there's something about an evening like this, I think, that it typifies London life, doesn't it? So much good stuff in London. London is sort of like life distilled. You get so much of the best stuff, don't you? The best entertainment, sometimes the best jobs, the best culture, the best experiences. It's all kind of distilled to be enjoyed in London. A recent Time Out magazine poll put London as the second greatest city in the world to live in. Second greatest city in the world to live in. What do you think was the first?
Birmingham.
Yes! You stole my gag. Sadly, it was not Birmingham, though it probably should have been. What do you think it was?
New York.
Easy. New York. Well, you can work out for yourself what you think. But even if it's only the second greatest city in the world to live in, here we are, living it up in the second greatest city in the world to live in. Samuel Johnson, a couple of centuries ago now, he said this: when a man is tired of London, he is tired of life. When a man is tired of London, he is tired of life. And I've been here 15 years, and I know what he means. There's still a big part of me that thinks, yes, London, I'm not tired of you yet. You just keep exciting me. You keep kind of giving me experiences that I'm enjoying, new things to look forward to. And yet, at the same time, when I think of those words, when a man is tired of London, he is tired of life, I think, yes, but part of me thinks no. Because, and if you've been here any length of time, you know this is the case. There often come moments, don't there, where the gloss wears off and the grind kicks in. You stood on the Northern Line in someone else's armpit. And you think, this is, you know, I'm tired of London, frankly. And in my experience, London is a city that often prompts the question that we've been tasked with trying to answer tonight. Is there more to life than this? Because don't get me wrong, the experiences are great and the lifestyle is fantastic and there's loads on offer. But time and again, I find people either out loud or just kind of with a niggling thought in the back of their heads asking that question, is there more to life than this? And I think people ask the question for lots and lots of different reasons. I think one big reason people ask the question is because actually we're hardwired to do that. You may have heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You come across that? Abraham Maslow was a psychologist from the last century, a Jewish psychologist. And he observed human beings and observed that almost instinctively we have a hierarchy of needs that we pursue, starting at level one and going all the way up to level five. Level one is our physiological needs, food, water, sleep, air, those kind of things. And he observed when that first level of need is met, we then start looking for the second level, that is safety, a home, a job, our health. When level two has been met, apparently we naturally then start looking for level three needs to be met. Those are love and belonging. You begin to see sort of a distinction between us, perhaps, and the rest of the animal kingdom at this point. Love and belonging, that is, we long for family and for friends and for social intimacy, you might say. Then it gets quite distinctive. Once those needs are met, we look for level four. That is esteem, apparently. The respect of others. A sense of achievement. A sense of self-confidence. Self-esteem, you might say. And then still one level up from that. When level four is met, human beings apparently start looking for what he called self-actualization. Self-actualization, that is to say, creativity or spontaneity, even morality. A set of desires and ambitions, if you like, that totally set us apart from any other species on the earth, I think. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Good observations, I think, that point to the fact that you and I are hardwired to ask the question, is there more to life than this? Is there more to life than just the material, than food and drink and good times? Sometimes people ask it from the perspective of relative youth, looking ahead to life. What else is going to come? What ambitions are yet to be met? Is there more to life than this? Others ask the question from the far end of life, from old age, looking back on everything they've done. Is there more to life than that? Either way, it would appear human beings are hardwired to ask the question. Sometimes I think people ask the question because they've encountered for themselves suffering. My experience is that suffering has this effect of sort of stirring us up as we find that the things we hold near and dear are sometimes taken away from us. The things that provided our security, the things that provided perhaps our satisfaction. And we're forced in those moments to ask the question, is there more to life than this? And then thirdly, in my experience, people ask the question because of an honest assessment of the impact of death in our world. Now, as I say that word, you feel the sort of awkwardness of it. Just talking about death. We're having a good time, having a drink, some food, chatting, and then I drop the D word in, death. And it's kind of awkward, isn't it? But often death does break in, and it causes people to ask the question, is there more to life than this? Because the effect of death, I think it's fair to say, is a bit like that of an eraser. That is to say, it kind of erases whatever significance we might have given to life before it. I think, for example, of famous scenes like the mausoleum, the grave of Tutankhamun, discovered in his grave, surrounded by huge, vast wealth. Indeed, he was buried apparently with three of his chariots to demonstrate the extent of his power and his authority. Yet when they opened the grave, there was he lying, wrapped in cloths, mummified, dead. And whatever significance his life might have had to that point, he couldn't take it with him. A great big full stop that, as it were, almost kind of took the rug from under the feet of the rest of his life. Leo Tolstoy, the Russian author, wrote this. He spoke of how in midlife he was plagued by a set of questions. He said they almost drove him to the edge of suicide. Listen to the questions he asked. He said, what will come of what I am doing today or tomorrow? What will come of my whole life? Why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? It can also be expressed thus. And listen very carefully to this, because there's a lot of insight in this question. He said, is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? I'll say it again so you can just chew on it for a second. Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? It's pretty bleak stuff, isn't it? And kind of a little uncomfortable to listen to, isn't it? To bring the reality of death quite so close. Especially in our culture, where we have a slightly odd relationship with death, I think. Which is to say, we basically, or maybe it's not odd, maybe it's normal, we just want to keep it at arm's length. I was talking to a friend of mine recently who was recounting a conversation he'd had with a friend of his who worked at one of the big credit card companies over in a different part of London. And he had gone to work one morning and had been told how the previous day, one of the senior executives had had a massive heart attack in his office on his own and had died. And his secretary had gone into the office and had found him there dead. She didn't know what to do, so she went next door to one of the other senior executives, who decided in collaboration with a couple of others to tell no one. Rather, they decided that instead of sort of, you know, interrupting business and getting in everyone's way, perhaps, you know, maybe telling everyone to take the day off and process what had happened, instead, they put a sheet over him and discreetly wheeled him out some back stairs down to an ambulance waiting for him below to take his dead body away. Now, my friend's friend had heard that news the following day and understandably was pretty troubled by it, by what it said about his company's values. Though when I heard the story, my ears pricked up because it spoke to me, really, in many respects, of our whole culture's attitude to death. We kind of want to keep it at arm's length. We don't really want to think about it. Understandably, I think. I think it's fair to say we fear death. We fear the reality of it. Which of us hasn't in the last few days imagined ourselves onto that Tunisian beach as death broke in, uninvited and unopposed? It's a pretty fearful thing, death, when you think about it for a second. And it sort of bites back into the present, doesn't it? It brings a sort of insecurity to it if you begin to think about death for a little while. Epicurus, the Grecian philosopher, who embodied the philosophy, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, he kind of coined that phrase almost. He said this: it's possible to provide security against other ills, but as far as death is concerned, we men live in a city without walls. Like it or not, death can break in unannounced and unopposed. We don't like the reality of it. We don't like the insecurity of it. And I don't think we like the implications of it either. That at the end of our life, there is that very real full stop that can render the rest of what we've done ultimately purposeless. Again, think of that credit card executive with his heart attack, sat there in his office. So much hard work. Maybe a big pension pot he was looking forward to, and yet today he's dead, gone, can't enjoy any of it. What is his life by way of significance to him? He can't take any of it with him. And perhaps most uncomfortable about all of this is that the secular, materialist, and often atheist agenda that you find in our culture, it has no answers to the question of death. Think about it for a moment. If you and I have come from who knows what, but the primordial sludge. If that's ultimately what we emerged from, a purposeless, insignificant beginning, just random and by chance, and you and I are heading towards the dust, dust you are, to dust you will return, purposeless insignificance. If that's what tops and tails life, it's pretty hard to argue for significance in between. We've come from nothing, we're going to nothing. Trying to find significance in between is almost a laughable thing to do. It's a bit like, imagine the scenario, over the road at the Tate Modern, there's a new exhibition of modern art. And there's a bunch of critics working their way around the room, piece by piece. And earlier in the day, a small child has accidentally vomited in the corner. And they haven't had time to tidy it up. And the critics go from piece to piece, and then they walk past, and they stop in the corner. And they look at the vomit on the floor and they start a conversation. What does it mean? What is its significance? What's the purpose behind it? What does it say to you? What does it say to me? We kind of laugh, don't we? And understandably. a ridiculous thing, a chance pile of vomit on the floor has no purpose and has no significance. Well, that's trying to find significance in a world where we've come from nothing and are going to nothing. There is no purpose. There is no significance. Don't waste your time trying to work it out. Is there more to life than this? Not according to the atheist, secularist, materialist worldview. What does the Bible have to say? Well, we're going to read a few verses now that I think begin to speak into this issue. And Anna Louise is going to do that for us. Anna Louise, why don't you come to the front? You've got the reading there on your cards.
While he was still speaking, they came from the ruler's house, some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age, and they were immediately overcome with amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and told them to give her something to eat.
Now that's a reading from Mark's Gospel, which is it's just an eyewitness account of the life of Jesus, recorded as history, not myth or legend or anything like that, just an eyewitness recounting what happened way back when. And we didn't start right back at the beginning of the story, but basically what has happened is that Jesus has been called by a man called Jairus, whose daughter is, as we know, literally on her deathbed. And he goes to Jesus and says, maybe you can help. And Jesus heads in that direction, but is caught on the way and delayed. And while he's delayed, as we discovered, the little girl dies. And it is a devastating scene that Jesus arrives to. Verse 38. You glance down. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. We respond to death a little differently in this country, don't we? We are more stoical, more sort of stiff upper lipped. In Middle Eastern cultures, it's very different. If you've seen the news, you'll have seen, I'm sure, what happens when there's a tragedy in a Middle Eastern setting. They weep, they wail, they beat their chests, they tear their clothes, they throw themselves on the floor. And that's exactly what happens here because of the tragedy of this moment. This little girl is just 12 years old. So untimely. So premature. So impossible to look at the scene and say, she's just a sack of cells and a bag of skin. Survival of the fittest, that's how it works. Move on, life is cruel. No, the pathos of this moment speaks to us even 2,000 years after the events. You can imagine how desperate it must have felt to Jesus and the others as they arrived. And these people from this Jewish culture weep and wail, not just, I think, because of the sense of personal loss they must be feeling, but because they are aware of the disconnect that death represents. They would have known their Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, that speaks of how humanity is created for more than just matter. We're eternal beings, if you like. The Bible says that God has set eternity in the hearts of man. We're not just about food and drink and the material. We're created for something more than that. But death speaks of a disconnect between us and God. A disconnect that we feel even now. You see, the fact that we're eternal speaks, I think, of, or explains, gives explanatory power to the desires that we feel and the ambitions that we have. The desire for, as Maslow called it, self-actualization. We long for more. As C.S. Lewis, the author, said, "If I have appetites that cannot be met by this world, the chances are I am created for another world." We feel the frustration of the disconnect with God now, and one day we will feel it fully and finally. Because death in the Bible is not just a physical reality, It's also a spiritual reality. You see, the Bible's account is that you and I as humanity have cut ourselves off from God. We were made for relationship with him, to live in his good world, giving him the respect, the love, the relationship that he deserves. We love his good world, we just don't love him. And so we get on with our life cutting ourselves off from him. And the Bible says that one day the implication of that will be that God will cut us off from him. So that death, if you like, is not just an eraser in terms of what its effect is on the significance of our lives lived. It's also like a chasm and a full final permanent one set between us and the God who made us. And so these people weep and wail because of the sense of disconnect that they are seeing lying in front of them. But as Jesus arrives on the scene, interestingly, he arrives with a sense of optimism. So verse 39, when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. And they laugh because they know they haven't made a mistake. Jesus, we know she's not asleep. That's why we're weeping and wailing. That's why we're reacting the way that we are. We were there when the blood drained from her face and the breath from her lungs and the life from her brain. We know she's dead. Thank you very much. Don't patronize us. But Jesus continues on because he knows he hasn't made a mistake. Verse 41, taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And who can blame them? You see, the people in this story are not gullible peasants, expecting the supernatural around every corner, unsurprised when someone rises from the dead, because that's just what they expect to happen. No, like us, they are thoroughly amazed. Someone has just been raised from the dead. And they want to tell everyone. That's the implication, isn't it, of verse 42? They want to tell everyone, and you can understand why. They have just got a very vivid glimpse of the fulfillment of their hopes and dreams, of their ambitions, of the possibility of life beyond death. All of the frustration, all of the pain, all of the discontent, gone. They're getting a sense of the possibility, as it were, of reconnection with God as Jesus comes in and makes this possible. And in Mark's gospel, this event, the raising of this little girl, is like a sort of taster dish, if you like. I remember when just before we got married, we went to our reception venue. They gave us three or four little samples, little taster dishes. And as we ate one, we got a taste of what it would be like at the reception. Well, this event is like a little taster dish of what is promised to everyone who will follow Jesus. Turn away from turning our backs on God and turn back to Jesus. If you like, anyone who will do what he suggests in verse 36, do not fear, only believe. It's a foretaste of what will happen to him. And it's a foretaste of what will happen to us if we'll follow him, because it's a foretaste of what will happen to him. If you take these Gospels away with you, or if you want to grab a fuller version, then we've got copies by the door. We'd love you to take Mark's Gospel away and just read it. But even if you haven't, I guess you know how it ends. You know that Jesus dies. He dies on a cross. Pretty much everyone knows that. But the way Mark tells it, and indeed the way Jesus himself explained it, that death was not just a tragic waste. That death was him dying in the place of his people. He died the death that we should die, so that if we'll trust him and follow him, we need not ourselves go through death. We need not be separated by that chasm. Rather, we can be reconnected with the God who made us. Jesus died. But even that wasn't actually the end of the story. Because the end of Mark's gospel has Jesus being raised from the dead. That stubborn, objective act and fact of history. There was a professionally verified corpse lying there, and then put in a sealed tomb. And then 3 days later, the tomb is open and empty, and there is a body. But more than a body, a person walking around, eating, drinking, bearing witness to lots of people, such that the news spread and spread and spread, and the message grew and grew and grew, so that here we are today, still talking about it. Now, the resurrection happened, but the resurrection of Jesus Christ points to a reality that is possible for anyone who follows him. Because as he pioneered his way through death and onto resurrection, he says, if you like, you can follow me. He makes resurrection life possible for anyone. And the resurrection life he promises is a reconnection with the God who made us. And because it's a reconnection with the God who made us, it's not just a continuation of day-to-day life. If I told you that you were just going to carry on with your life as it is today, forever and ever and ever, I suspect you might think twice about that. But the Christian account of resurrection is not just of continuation, but also of transformation. A world, a future where all of the bad things that mark out our existence are taken away once and for all and forever, and our bodies even are transformed for a remarkable future that will be beyond compare. Simply put, the Bible calls it good news. Very, very good news. But as we draw to a close, you might still be thinking, how does that answer the question that we set ourselves? Is there more to life than this? Well, the resurrection of Jesus answers by saying, there's more to life than this because there is more life than this. You and I were created for a deeper, fuller future. And that future bites back into the present. Indeed, whatever future you think of tonight bites back into the present. As we close, let me try and illustrate to help us think it through. Imagine you are asked to paint or draw a self-portrait, okay? But you've got my level of artistic ability. Some of you are probably thinking, I could do that, it would be quite good. You've got my level of artistic ability, okay? So that's a troubling thing to have to do. And you're told that one of three things is going to happen to your self-portrait. Either, in a few minutes' time, someone's going to come along, grab the self-portrait, tear it up, and throw it in the bin. Now, that affects the way you draw and paint, doesn't it? Who cares, frankly? If it's going to get thrown in the bin in a few minutes' time, just do what you want, paint what you want. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day. That's option number one for your self-portrait. Option number two is that someone is going to come along a little later on and take your best efforts and then hang it in what you might call a hall of shame, of some of the worst art painted by some of the ugliest people that will hang there forever. Now, that's what would probably happen to my portrait, for what it's worth. But if that's the future of that portrait, and you know it's going to happen, then there's nothing you can do to stop it. Again, that shapes how you paint. You sort of do your best, but it's a pretty desperate affair, a pretty, you know, depressing affair. You paint, but it's a pretty bleak future. Then there's a third option. That is that you're going to start sketching, but in a few minutes' time, a world-renowned artist is going to come and sit down next to you. And they're going to start talking to you about what your vision for this portrait is. And they'll then take the paintbrush out of your hand and they will start painting themselves. And in collaboration with you, they will produce something that is spectacular. The vision you really hope for your self-portrait. And then that portrait will be taken and hung in a hall of fame for the world to come and look at and marvel at for centuries to come. You might have been putting the pieces together as I spoke. The first version is, well, it's the materialist, secularist, atheist worldview biting back into the present. If your life is going to come to nothing in the end, it's going to get thrown in the bin, who cares what you do today? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. Stop asking the question. Is there more to life than this? No. Get on and live. Who cares? The second account is the account of the future cut off from God. The hall of shame, if you like. If that's our future, then that's bleak, desperate. We make the best fist we can of life, but it's a depressing affair because the future is so desperate. The third account is the account of the effect that the future resurrection that Jesus promises has on the present. You see, if the author, the artist, comes alongside you and tells you one day he'll transform you into a glorious vision that will be marveled at forever by the whole world, then that bites back into the present and transforms the way you paint, the way you live, the way you act, spectacularly. Is there more to life than this? Well, through the resurrection of Jesus, the answer is yes, there can be. Tim.
Great. Well, in a moment, there's going to be a chance to get more drinks. There's loads of strawberries as well that need eating, so together we can do it. Let me just mention a couple of things before that. It may be that I hope lots of people here have been perhaps surprised by something they've heard there. Perhaps you're more interested in it than you thought you might be. Perhaps you disagree with everything. Wherever we are, I mean, it'd be brilliant if that can be the start of a conversation. Let me just mention a couple of things you might want to do. Jamie mentioned the Mark's Gospels. So that little bit he was opened up with us is part of this, Mark's Gospel. And let me tell you, this is a really good read. So there are loads over by the door. Take it away, have a read. Again, I think there might be things in there that that are surprising to you, perhaps. Secondly, we'd love it. Come and join us on over at St. Helens. So we meet every Sunday, 6 o'clock in the evening. And we meet through the summer on a Wednesday as well, very similar timings to here, but over in St. Helens. Every time we meet, I guess we do something similar to what's just happened now. Someone like Jamie or someone else, as part of the evening, just explains a bit of the Bible to us in a helpful way and a chance to chat about it. So why not come and join us at some point over the summer? But then thirdly, as you grab drinks and as we eat those strawberries, let's start those conversations now. Lots of stuff we've been hearing about, whatever you're thinking on it. I'm guessing most people here have been invited along by a friend who's a Christian, who probably comes along to St. Helens. Why not chat with them about some of that, the things we've been thinking about this evening. So there's no rush to leave or anything like that, so enjoy the rest of your evening. Thank you.